Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is Brett Gilbert. We're talking about studio lighting because more and more broadcast engineers are being called upon to light something like a stage or a control room. That's coming up on Twerked. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the new Ruby console from Lavvo with AutoMix Smart Mixing. See Lavvo in your future at lavvo.com/twerked. And by the Telos VX Multi-Line Multi-Studio On-Air Phone System. Get return on investment and HD voice for your stations with Telos VX. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. Oh, it's going to be a good show, and I'm glad you've shown up. I'm not in my usual studio, as you can see. I'm at a undisclosed cabin in the woods in east of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, in the mountains here. Very close to the North Carolina border. In fact, I'm real close to the Appalachian Trail, a path that I will probably never walk on because it's pretty darn strenuous. So there you go. You've tuned into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And light is the subject of this week's show. So we'll be talking about that. Hey, I got to make a small excuse for my sound here. I'm in a game room here at the cabin. I'm a microphone here that is picking up a lot. So, Chris, how does this sound? Does it sound a little echoey, a little bouncy?
That's a little live, but it's fine. It's not distracting at all.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, usually I'm used to a very dead sound from my studio at home. So
yes,
welcome in, by the way.
Liveliness off is a little bit for you.
Yeah. Okay, good. I won't worry about it then. And welcome in, Chris Tobin. You're not in your usual location either, but we've seen you there before. Chris Tobin, our co-host from the New York City area. Chris, where are you at? What's going on?
I'm at Rutgers Newark Express. We have our public affairs show this month. Every month we do it. And tonight will be the State of the City Address for the City of Newark with the mayor and a few other dignitaries, public safety director. And we have, Community Economic Development Corporation person, council for the city, corporate council, and superintendent of public schools. So it's going to be a fun night.
Now, this is the forum that you kind of handle a lot of the video for this, right? Setting it up and make sure it works correctly? And I suppose
yes,
audio,
yes.
Too.
Yeah, there's two of us doing the setup. We have I'm overseeing the video. The other guy does the audio, and then we share getting cables in place and things of that sort. So, yes, we've got two cameras, a couple of lights, and we're off to the races.
Now, I see. I guess he's a photographer in the background, the guy in the red shirt. At first, I thought he was your parole officer, but he seems to have a camera with him.
No, he's one of the folks that helps us. He's with the building.
Ah, good. Okay. Oh, he's got a cell phone. Okay, good deal. All right. Well, thanks for being here. And I understand you've had some incredible weather there in New York City. What's going on with that?
We've had 3 nor'easters in 2 weeks. The weather conditions, the snow we had was not a flaky snow; it was a wet snow. So that gets the weight of the slushy snow wreaks havoc on, in the case of commuting, the overhead wires, the catenary wires on Amtrak and New Jersey Transit and Long Island Railroad. Metro North. So yes, getting around last 2 weeks has been interesting. I have to say it's amazing how things has come to a halt when the snow is not flaky. It's just wet and drags down the trees and goes crazy.
So, Chris, it's actually really good that you are in that location this week because you're doing a television coverage of what is also a radio show. This is on WBGO as well, right? The forum you're doing?
Yes. 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 This is a Facebook live stream. We also do the radio program. So we're doing it, streaming it on audio stream, video stream, and on the radio. Yes.
So tell you what, I don't want to go into it just yet, but I'm guessing you may have extra lights there for more than what you'd have for just a radio only show. And so our guest is Brett Gilbert. Now, Brett's been on before, and we've touched on the subject of lighting, but with so many engineers nowadays being asked to create a performance studio or add video to their regular control room, lighting is something that is either forgotten about, we don't know about it as radio engineers, we're not sure what to do about it, we may buy the wrong things, we may buy some things for lighting that we think are the right thing, and it turns out they're less than ideal, and we could have gotten what's ideal for maybe the same money, maybe less, maybe a little bit more than what we spent on something that wasn't ideal. And so I think it's just a great idea to try to get apprised of what you need to buy, what the concerns are for lighting in an existing control room or a performance place for both the purpose of television and for even if you're doing something outside, wherever you may be, whether it's televised or not, whether it's even just on the radio, just the audio, well, it's important to light people that need to get seen. And so that's what we're going to talk about. So let's bring our guest in right now, Brett Gilbert from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Brett, welcome in.
Hey, how's it going? Good to be here.
Good. Hey, I understand you've just had a great big move there in Tulsa. Yeah? New facility?
Yes. Well, it's somewhat of a new facility. We're actually moved into what was previously some existing radio studios, but it was a complete rebuild of the facility. So we just recently completed putting together a new performance space here at our old building. We had more of just a live studio. Well, it was more of a recording studio. It was built for doing on-air performances, and now we've transitioned more to a live studio where listeners and people can come in and enjoy the performance in person with the artist. So it's been a nice transition because now we do get to do like the lighting and stuff like that you wouldn't typically have more in a recording studio operation.
Good deal. And give us a little bit about your background in lighting, because one of the first times I ever met you, we talked about lighting and you had one of these big honking things. They hang from the ceiling or from poles and they got motors and whiz bangs and stuff that goes in front of the light, and you could remote control the whole thing. And I don't even know what you call that thing. And I don't think we're talking about a whole studio full of those, but give us a little bit of background on you and your interest in lighting.
Yeah. Well, actually it's kind of funny. I have been interested in lighting since, oh gosh, I was actually before I was in middle school, but, my actual kind of background before getting into radio was theater. I spent basically all of my middle school, high school, and even a little bit of college working in theater. And it was kind of a mix of both lighting and sound, but my favorite thing to do has always been lighting. I've just, it's one of those things that just I've always had a big interest in. And so, the sound part of the theater obviously was a real asset to switching over to radio. Just having, I've always had a pretty good ear for sound and stuff, but the with the new performance space and stuff like that, it's kind of fun to actually incorporate some of that lighting into our radio operations. But I still, even to this day, continue to even do lighting shows and stuff on the side for bands and stuff. So it's something over the years, I never really felt the big desire to go out on tour. I had some opportunities that I kind of passed up, but I've always kind of wanted to stay close to home. But I've always, lighting's always been kind of a big part of my life and stuff. And so it's an area that I've always, kept up on.
Chris Tobin, you're involved with lighting, cause I know you had some hand in building facilities that had performance places, and even the place where you are right now, you've got to set up lighting. Chris, why don't you give me a little bit about your background? You and I haven't talked about lighting very much on the show. Is Chris there? Oh my gosh. Oh, Chris. Oh, hey, Chris.
Sorry about that. Somebody asked some questions. That's cool.
No worries. Well, hey, I was asking you about your experience with lighting, because you and I haven't talked about that very much, and you've built some spaces, and you're primarily focused on the radio business. So tell me about lighting in your world in the radio business.
Basically, what I've always done with lighting has been the soft light, the approach of like splashing the room, just making the room soft and not focus beam lighting, if you will, spot beam in studios. Where this way, if an announcer or a disc jockey or whatever is sitting down, they don't have out of the corner of their eye a spotlight coming in. So the room is just well lit. That's what I try to do, and we've done it a couple of times in places, and it works out nicely. And then over the last couple of years with the video component, it's actually helped a lot with some of the cameras. You could just step down the f-stops and use the room splash light or the soft lighting. It works really nice. It's complimentary and it's less fatiguing, and it's handy. And especially in the places I've worked where we do all news, the anchor is sitting at a table. it can be very, very tiring when you have little spotlights over your head, track lights that are just focused on you. You know, it just doesn't work well.
Oh, yeah. Well, and radio folks probably aren't used to that. You know, when I do the when I do twerk from my regular office, I've got a couple of those big soft lights in my office. I never have put one back of my head because you're supposed to have a hair light. You know, when I do TV, we've got essentially.
You don't have to.
Yeah, you don't have to. I guess if you're a hair model, that it's probably a good idea too.
If you want to stand out, just light the backdrop behind you.
Oh, well, yeah. So Brett, kind of start us out. We got a few minutes before our first break. Give us a little bit of intro of what engineers need to think about if they're asked, you know, what are some lighting fundamentals for the kind of stuff that we would do? What's the advice you'd give people to start out?
Well, you know, one of the things, the reason I kind of thought about bringing up this topic again, you know, obviously we talked about the sound stuff a few years ago, but I think the biggest thing that has become advantageous now for radio facilities is that the cost of the equipment has dropped significantly. There's just a lot more producers out there, a lot more brands and stuff, and that makes it easier for facilities or stations to invest in providing some lighting for a space where they might have performances. So, you know, of course, one of the things that you do have to kind of take into consideration when lighting a space or lighting performers is obviously you do want something that looks natural on the performers. And, you know, obviously LED lighting has become a huge asset. Number one, it's obviously it runs a lot cooler. You don't have the heat being generated by the LED lights. The weight of the fixtures has come down with switching power supplies and stuff, and also just the cost of producing the fixtures. But one of the downsides with the early LED fixtures was a lot of them were typically just a standard LED fixture with a red, green, and blue. And that doesn't tend to have the best, you know, color rendering on faces and stuff. And now you're seeing a lot more fixtures out there that will have either an amber or kind of an orange LED element in it. Some will have a white. The particular fixtures I'm using right now have actually six different LEDs in each pixel. And it gives you a whole lot better color rendering and stuff. And they actually do make some LED fixtures that are just basically white LED fixtures, and you can vary the color temperature basically anywhere from incandescent all the way up to daylight. And so, you know, anytime I'm working in a space where it's important to light people's faces, I do try to pick some LED fixtures that tend to have, you know, really good color tones for people's faces. And then I'll use the more conventional like tri or quad LED fixtures for just accent lighting on the stage where it's not, you know, you're not using lighting the face as much. And so I think that's an important thing to take into consideration is just, you know, making sure that you have something that looks good on people's faces. The other thing that I always think is a very important thing, and this comes from just my theater background, is, you know, we're not two-dimensional beings. I mean, we're, you know, we have depth. And so it's always important to have lighting from multiple sources. You know, it's important to have, you know, obviously you do a lot of TV stuff. So, you know how you've got lighting behind you to light your shoulders and just something that gives your body depth so that you don't look like just a two-dimensional object. And especially with camera work, that's important to have, you know, that you can see there's some depth to the people on stage. And so those are some important things to take into consideration when planning.
Seems like one of the typical scenarios that an engineer listening to this show might run across is he's asked to, hey, we've got this new third floor open space in our building here, and we want to make a performance studio. Okay, so it only has maybe what, 9-foot ceilings? It's got a drop ceiling in it. It's not a place where I can hang a lighting grid, right? It's got fluorescent fixtures in the ceiling. They want you to build a little stage, which is going to further reduce the amount of headroom you have above you. Talk to me, Brett, about what would you do to take a typical office space that was large enough, and make it so you could put a little stage in there and put people on it and have a backdrop and have chairs in there, maybe accommodate 25 or 50 people and light it. And, and we'll talk about, cameras and stuff later, and then audio, that's probably pretty standard. Our listeners probably know the most about that already. What would you do to modify and light a space like that?
Well, I can speak from our experience here, because we had a room that had a drop ceiling in it, and unfortunately it had a lot of ductwork above that ceiling. So we had a very limited height to work with in the room. We ended up with about a 1-foot stage, and what we ended up doing was using what sometimes people call eye truss, and we flipped it on its side. Instead of using a standard triangle or a box truss, we took that eye truss and laid it flat. Of course, it requires a little more support from, whatever steel trusses or whatever you might have in the building to suspend it from. But we were basically able to bring that truss right up against the ceiling. I mean, it is literally flush against the ceiling. And then we mounted all the light fixtures and the speakers straight to that truss, but that saved us about 8 to 12 inches of height by going with that particular trussing. And we're just using all LED fixtures, and we're just using what are called cheese burrows on the clamps, which also saves us some height as well versus using a standard C clamp. So the other nice thing about using like a cheese burrow type clamp is that because it clamps completely around the truss, you can also rotate that clamp off at like 45 or 90 degrees, and it'll hold its position very well, because it gets a solid clamp around that aluminum tube. And so that can also give you a little bit of a few more inches of savings there. And it's worked quite well for us. We still have about a foot to 2 foot of clearance. The one bad thing about having a trim height that is that low is you do tend to, have some problems with light in the performer's eyes. And so what I try to do is I always try to have the lights out towards the edges. And then I like to purchase lights that have gel frames on the LED fixtures, because then I can go in and put some diffusion in those lights and soften it up some, and it takes a little bit of that harshness out of the lights. And so that makes it a little easier on the performers. But and that is a tough situation to work with sometimes. But there's things you can do that kind of mitigate it some.
Hey, so the lights you're talking about here, you've mentioned LED style lights, and I guess I didn't realize you could get LED lights bright enough to effectively light the thing. But come to think of it, at TV stations I've worked at now, we've had either fluorescent, these really bright fluorescents, or now LED lights. But tell me, these fixtures you're talking about, are they round aperture, or are these some kind of a rectangle or square aperture that you're wanting to get a gel in front of?
You can pretty much... Now, as far as using a gel frame, all of the ones I use are basically a typical PAR shape. It looks like a small flat PAR can, or some brands, some people call them a little LED puck, because it looks like almost like an oversized hockey puck. But it still has the same clips on the side so that you can slide a gel frame into it. And the ones I'm using right now, I'm using some American DJ. They are the, the 12, I'm just trying to remember now. it is the Hex 12P, And it's got a red, green, blue, white, amber, and an ultraviolet element in it. But it comes with the gel frame clip, so that you can just slip the gel frame in there. And I typically use like a Lee brand diffusion in it that just kind of takes a little bit of the edge off of the light. And the other thing that I like to do that can kind of help performers in a situation like that with a low trim height is in our space, we put some track lights over the audience that lights the audience from the back. And that allows the performers to see the audience, and they don't feel like they're looking into just this black abyss and they can't see anybody in the room with them. And you tend to see that a lot also when you watch like concerts that are shot for video. You'll see that they tend to deploy a lot of fixtures out over the audience and stuff just so that you can, feel that the crowd's out there and you can see and interact. And of course, also with concerts, they'll have things like LED blinders and stuff. But the other thing you can do is use some LED strip lights. Sometimes you'll see on various stages and stuff, they'll put some LED strip lights along the foot of the stage as well to help with lighting from the ground up. And also that can provide some interesting effects as well for with the performers. I use some LED strip lights in the back, and they're actually motorized. And so I can actually take that entire LED bar and tilt it up and down. And so there's sometimes when we have a performer in there and they're kind of interacting with the crowd, I'll actually tilt that LED bar up and light up the audience from the back of the stage.
I just thought of something we've talked about here on the show before. Chris Tobin, you remember at least a couple times we've talked about getting a tour of the of Kix Brooks studio in Nashville. This is at the Cumulus Nash facility. And Kix Brooks has this incredible man cave there at the studio. And it's a recording studio, it's a television studio, and it's his office. And you talk about a man cave, it's just beautiful. And we're getting a tour there one time, and Brett, I'm sure you're going to say, because we see these little light packs, Brett, sitting around on the couch here and there, and because there's a lighting grid overhead, and it's not a lot, but it's enough to light up, for an intimate kind of interview with Kix Brooks and whoever he's talking to, but these are these light packs sitting on the couch. And I had to ask, I said, so at that time it was Gary Klein. I said, Gary, what are these light packs for? He says, well, we interview a lot of country artists here. I said, yeah, that's kind of what it's for. He said, a lot of them are men. I said, yeah, probably so. Probably a little more than half. He said, yeah. And most of them wear cowboy hats. I said, oh, this is to light up under the hat brim, because hat brims make shadows. And you can't see the eyes of the person you're interviewing. So they put a light pack on a nearby couch or on the floor, and they just shine some light up into the interviewee's eyes. Brett, do you ever have that situation going on with cowboy hats?
Well, not here, but I did years ago. I was doing a show with, I think it was Junior Brown, and he used to wear a big old hat. And the funny thing was the road manager insisted that they have a spotlight for the show, and the particular venue was had a pretty low height, pretty low trim height. And I warned the road manager, I said, this spotlight is going to burn holes through the back of his skull. It's just the light's going to go in the front of his eyes, and it's going to put holes in the back. And they're like, oh, no, Junior's used to this. He'll lower his hat, and, he'll be fine. About two songs in, the road manager came to the back and said, turn the light off. You're just killing him. And I was like, hey, I tried to warn you, because, normally when you're in an arena or some other, concert venue, typically you can get the spotlights up a little higher where it's just not directly in somebody's eyes. But, smaller venues, that does become a problem. And I've always thought it's kind of a nice little look. I think, what was it, MTV, when they used to do their unplugged stuff, they used to at the time they were the old MR16 light strips, and they used to line those kind of around the edge of the stage, and it gave a nice warm uplight to the performers. And, I've started noticing in some TV studios now that it seems like they're building in little LED strips and stuff into the sets to provide some uplighting as well. I noticed there was a TV station here in town that's done that on one of their sets to kind of fill in, you know, just so you don't get those shadows kind of like under your nose and stuff like that and under your chin and stuff.
Well, that's exactly what the TV station that I do work for on the weekends doing weather at the anchor desk. There are LED strips just above the monitor through the glass to lighten up the eyes some. But they don't have this in the weather center. I need to ask them, hey, how about some strip lighting in the weather center? Make us look a little prettier. Chris Tobin, what's been your experience with with LEDs in unusual lights, not cans or big panels, but placing lights in very strategic places?
Well, let's see. When we did the Mike Francesa studio at WFAN, we had the lights above standard lighting on a truss, and then we had the LED packs, if you will, on the countertop where he would have the microphone. He's talking, and he doesn't wear a hat. But the reason we were doing that for a couple of the positions was they would put their head down to read something, and it would be just the right angle where you'd create, as Brett pointed out, the shadows. And it's like, wow. So we had these little LED lights that you can adjust. They were barely on. It was just enough to fill. It was literally a fill light. And a lot of folks, when you walk them through the studios, they say, what is this? This is weird looking. Because every position had these square looking amber boxes. And they're like, oh. And at first, we never even realized it until we did the first two or three shows. And we're like, but the imaging doesn't look right, and that's what it was. Just a hair. It was just a little bit. Not enough to be, like, obvious, but just enough that if you say, you know what, you used to watch that for an hour or two, you got to start to notice those shadows, and that's what it was. And we did that for that, Boomer and Carton. We did it for a couple of other shows we worked on, and the fill lighting became a regular thing. The kits we'd put together, we'd like, okay, we got the regular, key lights, if you will. We use all the terms, key lights, and then we did fill lights. What size? We have three different sizes just for that reason. We do stuff at an ad hoc position, and we just ducked a gaffer tape it to a mic stand out of the frame, and we just enough to create the fill. Like, say, in your shot, it was almost like Red Ramp, where you have one side is lit, and the other side is like a very mild shadow effect. Mm-hmm. We had some producers that didn't like that, so we'd have to have a little baby fill on your left side so that you get an even light across. I mean, it was the things I learned was great. And also remember, with lighting, I always tell this, if you're an RF person, you can appreciate lighting because you have to remember one of the laws of lighting, the inverse law. That's all I'm going to say. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Brett knows what I'm talking about.
Inverse distance law. Hey, we're going to take a quick break here and hear from one of our sponsors, Lavo. And when we come back, I want to get some more practical advice from Brett about the different styles of lighting, because I'm still not sure I would know what to buy. And maybe, Brett, you can even, for our tip at the end of the show, Brett, maybe you can come up with a website or a YouTube video that would get people started. And hey, do I need to buy panels? Because I kind of am partial to panels because there they are and they don't hurt your eyes as bad. Or do I need, in some instances, when do I need real, round spotlight sorts of things? So I'm curious to hear about that. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you by our friends at Lavo. Let's hear from them right now. I'll be right back.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. And if you want to check out their stuff, please do go to lawo.com and put the /twert from there. Let them know that we sent you there and that you are a fan of the show. Appreciate that. All right. We are talking to Brett Gilbert. Chris Tobin is with us as usual, and Brett is here as well. Brett's talking about lighting for special occasions at broadcast facilities, especially as more and more of us engineers are called on to provide a television-like environment for broadcasting. So, hey, guys, I want to take just a minute to pause and talk about the piece of news that came across today. We do call the show This Week in Radio Tech, and it was our intention when we started the show to talk about topical things. And a lot of things we don't. There's often not really earth-shattering news in the world. I mean, there's acquisitions here and there in the world of broadcast equipment manufacturing. There are changes in rules that we talk about when they take effect and affect us, like the main studio rule that was just done away with. But and I sure don't want to talk bad about these folks, but our friends at Gates Air, and we've had some of them on the show with us and have a lot of respect for what they do there. They announced today that they are suspending the sale of new AM transmitters. That seems pretty newsworthy. A prominent radio engineer passed along word to Radio World that he'd sought a quote from them on a new transmitter, but was told the company had discontinued the model and was assessing its AM line, so we sought to learn more. Chief Product Officer Rich Redmond replied, recent changes in the long-term availability of critical components from our suppliers and several last-time buy notices have caused us to take some proactive steps to ensure we can meet our continued obligation for our AM products. So they want to make sure they have a product to support with, but as far as selling new AM transmitters, sounds like they are starting that. So, wow. What's your reaction to that news, Chris Tobin, Harris, or Gates Air, discontinuing sales of AM transmitters?
Well, it's one of the things about manufacturing of anything, in this case we'll say AM transmitters, is part supply. And the industry that we're in, and I say this a lot, I've said this to people in meetings, our industry compared to, say, consumer electronics, is we're the pimp on the back of the elephant. So if you're a manufacturer and your sole business is, in the case of broadcast television, FM, AM, maybe shortwave, you have to be very cognizant of your supply chain and whether or not it's going to be available in 7 years. Because I think in some states, if you're manufacturing products or selling products in that state, you have to be able to guarantee, I think, support for several years. I forget the numbers because I remember someone telling me that once in California, they have to keep parts available for a period of time as part of the business law. So, Gates Air is probably looking at the situation going, okay, we make our transmitters. They're very good transmitters. They work very well. However, the parts may be becoming sparse. Maybe, say Analog Devices decides a particular IC chip. Say, we'll say audio preamp chip, SSM 2017. I re-say that only because I had to look that up recently. That's in a Harris product, of an old obsolete product. And when you look up the data sheet online, it says obsolete. Availability unknown. So think of yourself as a manufacturer of mic preamps using an SSM 2017, and you're like, uh-oh, now what do I do? It's not as simple as just pulling out the chip and popping a new one. And you have to redesign the board. You have to test it, make sure there's no anomalies in the way the board works. So, yeah, Gates Air, I mean, Rich Redmond, I know Rich, and he's a good guy and knows exactly how to tell people, look, this is the reality. We're going to keep supporting those of you that have purchased, but moving forward, we may have to put a hold just to say, let's reassess. Who knows? You know what? In a month or maybe at NAB, they may come out and say, guess what? We've taken a redesign on AM and here's how we're going to do it. And this is the new product line coming out in the fall. I'm just saying it's very possible. Yeah. But as a manufacturer, it's tough. Well, even at Telos, I'm sure you've had it in in various iterations of the early Zephyr. I remember DSP chips disappearing because they were no longer being made or couldn't support them. And you had to say, You have a Model 1 Zephyr? Hmm, yeah. Sorry, we can't give you the MPEG L2 in that one. Oh, no, sorry, MPEG 3. You'll have to just buy a new one. So it's not uncommon.
It's funny talking about old components. I have right here at my desk, I found a couple of years ago, we had a VRC 2000 get blown up, and I found a company called Innovasic that bought the rights to the microprocessor chip, and I've held on to these because they sent me a couple of samples where I could repair old VRC 2000s.
Yeah.
There you go. Perfect example. Yeah.
Good idea, and I can tell this story about a Telos product that's long gone, and that is the Telos One. Due to the unavailability of parts, that thing was the Telos One Hybrid, the most popular one I think they've ever sold, was actually redesigned internally 3 times just to meet changing parts availability. And on the outside, you never knew it. But of course, there were revs to the motherboard, and we said that. And then there were wholesale part differences inside because of non-availability. A lot of folks are using the Telos NX and the Telos 2X12 line with their big desktop directors. Well, there's a part in the desktop directors that is absolutely unobtainable now. We bought the last 500 in the world, and half of them didn't work. So, they were gray market to say the least. But we did that to try to, keep being able to repair people's units. So it is, unless you're Apple, of course, it's probably tough being Apple too. But the truth is that, manufacturers who do small quantities, we have to figure out what's Apple and Samsung going to use in their products, because we better use the same thing at least for a while. It's true. Can be tough. Yeah. So, yeah, I wish Gates the best on that and the right decisions. And, like you, I know Rich Redmond. He's a top guy, he will be forward and frank with everybody he needs to be that way with. So.
And they have some of the best engineering people. I mean, anyone's been out to Quincy and anyone's ever talked with the engineers that come out to the NAB show floor over the last 30 years, these are guys, they understand, they know the business. And they can take something and go, okay, maybe we come up with this. Once they come up with the design, then the trick is, as Kirk will tell you, you now have to figure out, how do I manufacture this at the most inexpensive cost at the highest gain, the highest return on the investment of design? But those guys have been great at that stuff. You look at the transmitters, look at the models, the technology they put in them. So for them to say that their AMs have to be put on hold, I'm guessing they did as Telos did for, say, the Telos 1 or the Zet or the 1x12s. They did everything they could to find a way to keep things moving and said, wow, this is going to be interesting. I applaud them. I said, do it now. This is the way to do it. Do it now and don't get caught with your pants down when all of a sudden 20,000 people start calling for transmitters and you're like, sorry, can't do that.
Yep. All right. Hey, well, let's get on with our lighting discussion. And Brett, I'm still curious because it's still pretty gray in my head about the design of the lighting that I'm going to choose for a given space. Do I need, lots of different kinds of lighting? Can I get by with one style of lighting? Do I, in fact, need to be able to project different colors? I guess what appeals to me is using some of these flat panel LED panels, because to me, they're spread out. They don't hurt the eyes quite as much. I don't think they do. Maybe I'm wrong. You correct me. And it just seems like several of those along a ceiling and a couple in the back or sides, and I could be set to go for a decently lighted stage. But something tells me I'm not thinking it all the way through.
Well, I think it kind of depends on, what your usage of the space is. If it's just basically, something where you're lighting, a radio show, and they're not really having performers or a band in the space, then, buying some panels that actually LED panels that have, a color temperature adjustment would probably work just fine. Something like you might find in, TV studios or something. In our particular case, we knew we were going to have performers, we don't really have the space for people to like dance up on stage, but we do have some room to move around. And last week we had a 5-member group in there. And so basically when I designed the space, I wanted a space that I had a good white source for the front to light the performer's space, or the face. And then I wanted a couple of accent lights that I'm actually using some older Co-MR. They're actually in the discrete RGB fixtures. And I'm not a huge fan of the discrete fixtures because if you have objects that cast shadows, then you'll get this, you'll get kind of that look of, you may have seen it like in a science museum where they have, you can stand in front of a red, green, and blue individual lights, and then you cast the rainbow of colors behind you, your shadow does. So, but I use those just kind of as some basic accent lighting just on like instruments and stuff like that. And then in back, I use the combined fixtures that don't have the discrete elements. There's basically in each pixel, there's a kind of a lens that merges the colors together. And so I use those in back just because it it looks better to the audience. You don't see these individual pixels. Although I will say there are some fixtures out there that have those individual pixels that have these kind of neat patterns that you can, you know, maybe the reds in the shape of a triangle and the blues in the shape of a square. And then the green elements are in the shape of a circle. And so, you know, some lighting designers use that as an effect in the performances, but you know, nowadays I don't really, you know, like to use that very much, but so my lights in the back are more for just, we have moving lights in the back and we use those to sometimes scan the crowd and stuff. So, you know, you really have to take a look at, you know, what is going to be your application? You know, if I was lighting the studio of a morning show, you know, I might want to have some, you know, colored lights around the, or the ability to change the color of the lights that, maybe shine down on the walls of the studio, but yet more towards, you know, as Chris mentioned, you know, where the, actual hosts of the show are located, you know, you may just want just, you know, white fixtures. And, you know, for our application, we've pretty much, you know, stayed with LEDs just because of the lower heat and the lower power use. And, you know, obviously with, you know, fluorescent fixtures, they can tend to throw off a fair amount of heat. And, you know, that, you know, that's something that, you know, obviously with more heat and stuff, that's, you know, then that adjusts or changes your heat load in the studio.
So we've talked a lot about the fixtures and some different designs there. And I'd like to, before we go again, maybe your tip for us would be, you know, where to find out information about these, but now let's talk about controlling these lights. I know that there's been this, control thing. There's been DMX. I think there's been some other protocols, and I'm curious about Brett, are we moving into a world where we can use cat cable, to run our protocols and eventually get to IP addresses on our lighting fixtures?
Absolutely. I mean, that's become a huge thing because if you go out and look at a modern concert now, the channel count of a modern lighting rig is just insane. Of course, DMX 512, there's basically 512 channels, and each one has 256 steps of resolution. Well, when you start looking at, for instance, fixtures that have pan and tilt, originally when early lighting fixtures came out, you know, if you take a modern day light fixture with a pan and tilt capability, you may have 540 degrees of resolution in that pan function. Well, obviously 256 doesn't go into 540 very well. You'd have some huge jumps every time you adjusted that channel to adjust the pan of the fixture. So most modern lighting fixtures, most of them will have a 16-bit resolution on that pan and tilt. So right there, you've eaten up four channels. And then you start figuring in, if you're just looking at like a wash fixture, well, you've got a channel for your red, a channel for green, a channel for blue. You may have a speed control channel, an intensity control channel. You may have, generally you'll have a control channel that allows you to, for instance, reset the fixture remotely. If, let's say it gets bumped or something and it's out of position, well, you can rehome the fixture. And then, you may also have, depending on the type of wash fixture, you might have some kind of a zoom function that you can vary the zoom of that, of that field of light. And so if you start taking all of that into account, it's easy to just chew up those 512 channels real quick. So years ago, most manufacturers started switching over to some form of Ethernet DMX. And there's different standards out there. Some of them are proprietary to a particular brand, but then there are other standards that are basically open standards. One of them is called ARTnet, and then there's another one called SACN. You know, the one thing you do kind of have to take into consideration is some of these protocols are much like audio over IP. You don't want to mix them with other networks because some of them are just broadcast packets. And obviously, you don't want to be throwing all of that traffic out onto your business network or your or maybe an audio network or something like that. So it's best to, you know, when possible, keep them isolated. But I will say one of the cool features that I have actually done on a number of shows is as long as you don't get what we call the universe count too high, you know, typically for a radio facility or something, you know, you may only need 1, 2, 3 universes of DMX, and each universe is 512 channels. Well, I've actually done some shows where I've run ARTnet and SACN across Wi-Fi. And so that's pretty cool when you sit there and think about that you can literally, I do have a lighting control application called Luminaire. It's made by a company called SynthFX, and it operates on an iPad. It runs on iOS. So literally, you can have your lighting console is basically just an iPad. And that's a really simple way to do it. And then basically the Wi-Fi, you just send that ARTnet or SACN across the Wi-Fi, and then you have typically they SynthFX recommends using what's called an open DMX Ethernet device that's made by a company called Intech, and it just takes that Ethernet data and converts it back to DMX 512. Of course, the great thing that you know we had talked about previously is, you know, the fact that DMX 512 is just a balanced data signal. You can basically, if you're thinking about building out a facility, just build it out with Cat 5, because that Cat 5, you can either put DMX 512 on it by putting XLR connectors on it, or you can, you know, throw RJ45s on it and, you know, basically run, you know, one of the, either ARTnet or SACN across that that Cat 5 to your basically, for lack of a better term, you know, the protocol converter that converts it back out to DMX 512.
Wow. So you're suggesting if you're going to build a new facility, build it with Cat 5 for the control wiring. By the way, is there any chance of these fixtures being powered over Ethernet, or is that just a pipe dream? Is that not possible?
Not powered over an Ethernet, but there are fixtures out there that can respond to Wi-Fi. They okay. can, and there okay. are some, and there are some fixtures out there that are also Ethernet capable. But you know, typically you're starting to get into higher end fixtures that, you know. Yeah, there are a lot of tours out there that use wireless DMX. The big YouTube tour years ago, where they had the big claw, and they went out on those the stadium tour. They actually had a Wi-Fi device at the very top at the claw that sent wireless DMX out to the pods of lights that surrounded the stadium. And so basically, you know, it was just going to be impossible to run data cabling to all those fixtures. Mm-hmm. So they opted to use wireless DMX. And there's a number of companies out there. City Theatrical is one of them. There's another company. I can't remember if City Theatrical is the one that makes the WDMX system. Chris may know as well. There's several manufacturers out there that make really good wireless DMX systems out there, but the good ones are pricey, because, you know, if you sit there and think about, you know, sending that kind of that much data across a wireless link, you need a really robust wireless link for that. You know, for smaller things like a performance space, I would always just hardwire. It's one less thing to go wrong.
Or one less thing to get hacked.
Yes.
Perhaps. Yeah. So, wow. Now that's amazing that we have. Yeah. So if you have a fixture or some fixtures that need to go in hard to get to places or far, you know, it would be a lot of cable to get there. Yeah. There's probably power there. That's, you know, there's power at all the places you might want to do that. But that's one less cable to have to run if you can get that wireless and have it good and secure.
Yeah. And if you, there are some manufacturers that, their fixtures come with wireless cards already in them, but sometimes you may have to stay within that manufacturer's brand or that particular brand to stay compatible. I really haven't used that much wireless DMX, but you know it can be quite popular for touring concerts and stuff, especially when they've got a place, you know, light fixtures out in the arena, you know, up in highway places and stuff. So it can be advantageous, but it's, you know, it's another thing that, you know, what one of the things that concerts and tours have to do now is, you know, just like NFL game day, they have to do frequency management for all of the wireless mics and stuff. Well, they have to do frequency management for the lighting system if they're, you know, taking a wireless system out, because they have to make sure that channel is open and it's not going to be interfered with. Because the last thing you want is, you know, lights glitching and stuff in the middle of a show.
Almost as bad as audio glitching. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Hey, we're going to do hear from our friends at the Telos Alliance in just a second, and then we're going to have our tip of the week from both Chris and hopefully Brett can give us some tips as to maybe websites or other resources that engineers like us could learn more about it. Hey, and Brett, I need to ask you, do you have any experience with the Telos VX phone system?
Actually, I do. We've got a VX here in Tulsa.
Oh, good. Okay, we're going to run some video.
Yeah. We've got several running here.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I think our producer is going to run some video, and we're going to perhaps talk over it if the video's there. If not, we'll just talk about the Telos VX. This has been an amazing thing. This is the last project that Steve Church really got to work on before his passing, and he did for several years. And Steve and I got to talk about, you know, we were dreaming about the Telos VX and stations going to an all voice over IP technology, where we had to build a box that would basically manage voice over IP extensions, if you will, user agents. That's the telephony word for the endpoint of a voice over IP connection. And then we could group these user agents, if you will, these endpoints into shows. We could define a show like a radio show. And then we could also define extra lines like a hotline, a warm line, a pizza guy line, you know, a girlfriend line, whatever you have in the studio. Then we'd also have to be able to, you know, do call screening and other call management functions with that. Then we would want to do Omnia audio processing on these phone calls, right? And then we'd want to have the best mix minus, the best hybrid technology available, and then also install something in there that you can optionally turn on called acoustic echo cancellation. This is a technology from Fraunhofer. And we also have to let people know how they can convert from their existing phone lines into the Telos VX. So can the VX work with my existing phone lines like POTS or ISDN, T1, PRI? Can it do that? Yes, you can, using gateways, or even better, bringing those kinds of lines into an external asterisk-based PBX system. And that's very popular to add to your Telos VX. Gives you functionality that the Telos VX by itself just can't have. So an asterisk SIP server or asterisk PBX is very helpful. Something else that an asterisk PBX can do for you, so you get your Telos VX system. Now you've got the availability of the G.722 algorithm to go in there. And what that means is you can have calls on the air that use G.722, which is considered to be HD voice. Now, look, I know in the broadcast world, G.722 is kind of a Plan C codec if you're doing a live remote broadcast. A lot of people use it for sports remotes, for example. But if you're used to the quality of a telephone call and all of a sudden bam, your caller is using G722. Wow, it sounds fantastic. I mean, compared to what you're expecting. So you can send your own staff out in the field with an ordinary cell phone, right? And you put an app on there, InPhone or Bria, and that speaks G722. And then using an asterisk SIP server at your studio, you can actually, it doesn't have to be the studio, but you know, it needs to be one that you have some control over. You can make your these phones, these employees, extensions off of that phone system. Your employees can just dial an extension, talk to any control room, any production room, any of the call screener people, and they're talking with G.722 voice quality. So you can have your own employees. Hey, you're out and about. You got a car wreck you need to cover, or a major event, or a live remote broadcast. Now you've got 7.5 kilohertz audio voice quality over the cellular network and into your phone system. And you just put them on the air. You don't need separate codecs. You don't need racks full of stuff. You don't need to decide, oh, is this codec assigned to that studio or this studio? No, they come in on your phone system. The buttons are right there. And you, so you can get this really high quality sounding remote broadcast just as part of your phone system. It's so, number one, it does turn out to be easy. It's easy for the people to use. It's not hard to set up. And it's all part of what the Telos VX is. The Telos VX also uses audio over IP in the studio. So if you already have a live wire set up with Axia consoles and Axia distribution throughout, this becomes really simple. You install the Telos VX system, you arrange for your phone lines to come into it or to an asterisk, and then you deploy some Telos VSETs, VSET 6, VSET 12, and maybe some call screening software, which by the way comes free with the Telos VX, and then bam, you're on the air. There's no additional wires to run. Your phone calls appear on your console on the faders that you assign. Now, if you're not a live wire shop, no problem. You just install a few of these Telos Alliance X nodes, and that gives you either analog inputs and outputs or AES inputs and outputs. So you can connect that right up to whatever system you have. So you have an analog plant, you have an AES 3 plant, or you have an audio over IP plant from some other manufacturer. No problem. Just plug it right in and connect using baseband, as you might call it, analog or AES 3. So the Telos VX, the other thing it can do for you, and I did a whole video about this after I researched this thoroughly and talked to people who actually saved a ton of money. And that is, you can, when you switch to voice over IP, you can get voice over IP at far lower cost than you can get POTS service or T1 or any other of the usual regulated services provided by the incumbent provider. So there's a number of different sources that you should have in your location for voice over IP. A lot of folks go with the managed VoIP, costs a little bit more, but it's absolutely assured. It should be as reliable as your POTS service. You can do unmanaged SIP. You can do SIP over the internet, which is what my radio stations do. We just try to get the very best internet we can for other business purposes as well at our stations. And our PBX is offsite. It's off in Denver somewhere. And it does work beautifully. So check it out. The Telos VX, I mean, we have put, I want to say close to 1,000 of these in radio stations now. Big broadcasters like ABC News in New York to small broadcasters all over the world. And there's even a less expensive version of the Telos VX. It's VX Prime. So if you only have a couple or three studios, get the less expensive VX Prime. Check it all out. Go to telosalliance.com and look under Telos for broadcast phone systems, the Telos VX. And it's amazing. I just love it. And it's absolutely the way to go to reduce your costs and get your phone quality as high as it can possibly be. Plus, give yourself HD voice in the process. All right. Thanks a lot to Telos Alliance for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Brett, I'm going to save you for last and hit up Chris Tobin with his tip of the week. Chris, I'm sorry you've been silent for a few minutes. Hopefully you're still there with the tip for us.
I'm still here. No, I'm still here. Since we're talking lighting, we're going to do a portable light meter for your iPhone. That's the way to go.
What?
So if you're doing video work.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, look at that. Look at that. So those are the cameras we're using tonight. You can see the Sony there. And then there's the stage. But it gives you all the information you need, and it's a portable light meter. And if you're going to do video in your studios or recording video for performances in your studio facility, it's very handy. Or you could just purchase a standard light meter and go with that as well. But so it's important to understand.
An app? There's an app on the phone? App.
This one is an iOS. This one's an iPhone app, yeah. It's just called the Pocket Light Meter. I mean, there's several.
Wow.
This one happens to be free, but you can purchase some of the better ones. It's pretty close. I have a friend of mine who's a photographer. We compared that to his light meter, and it was close enough to do the work you're doing. You know, if we're doing cinematic stuff, it's a little different. But it's pretty cool. It works nicely.
Well, if you search the app store, you get Pocket Light Saber or Pocket Light Meter. I'm going with the meter.
Yes, the meter,
not the lightsaber.
But you know, wow, I have to think to remember. Go ahead, Brett.
I found one for my Android that I use that has the color temperature, and I'd be curious to compare this to see how accurate it is, because obviously, you know, color temperature can, you know, be an important you know, something that, you know, needs to be set correctly with the cameras that you're using.
Yeah, and this app also has a color temperature indicator on it as well, so you can see what's going on. It's pretty versatile. But you know, I have to say one tip, an additional tip, that is, if you're going to do lighting in your studio, understand the principles behind light. And as I said earlier, the inverse law concept, but there's a few other things. And remember, as Brett pointed out, you know, spotlighting is nice in certain conditions, or photojournalistic approach if you do, but you really need to consider the soft light approach. And remember the shadows. You don't want them under the eyeballs. And if it's under the nose or chin, it's got to be very subtle. So it's complimentary, not, you know, dreary or satanic, you know, crazy looking.
Yeah, yeah. All right, good. Pocket Light Meter, and we might put a link to a couple other apps in there as well. Awesome. Thanks so much, Chris. Great idea. All right, spotlight's on you.
Brett. Okay. Well, my I guess I could say my tip is that, you know, obviously with all the lights and stuff like that, the other thing you need to worry about is how are you going to control your light fixtures and stuff. And so obviously there are quite a few options out there for hardware controllers and stuff. There's some consoles that, you know, run upwards of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you know, and that's obviously, you know, out of the price range for most, you know, most smaller facilities and stuff, unless you've got, you know, a big national facility that's getting shared by a lot of, you know, big artists. But the neat thing is several manufacturers, Martin, which is one, which actually they just changed ownership. Martin has now been purchased by Alation, and that actually just came out yesterday, I believe. But they have their MPC software, which is available for free. And all you need is basically a DMX output device. And there's obviously several different options, SACN, USB, and so forth. But the cool thing about some of these software applications like the MPC for Martin or Alation is that while the software is free and you don't necessarily have a control surface to go with it, there are people out there that have written different applications to interface with it. For instance, the MPC series supports OSC, which is a common protocol out there for remote control. So that allows you to control the lighting software, kind of like the SynthFX Luminaire. There is an OSC app for the iPad or for Android devices, so that you can basically activate scenes that you've programmed from a tablet. And then there's another guy that's actually written software. His name's Ricardo Diaz, and he has a software called MPC Tools and GMA Tools for the Grand MA series of consoles made by MA Lighting. But basically, the software will allow you to connect any standard MIDI device. So like you see all these little MIDI controllers that DJs like to use, and I've got one right here. This was one that's made by Ableton and Akai. And so basically it's just got a USB interface on the back. And his software converts that USB MIDI interface over to commands that the console will understand, or the software will understand. And that way you don't have to buy the, you know, the real high-end control surface to go with it. So that's one thing that's happened the last few years. That's really nice for people that want to keep their budget low is, you know, you've got companies like, you know, Martin with the MPC or Relation. You've got MA Lighting that they offer the same thing. It's called MA on PC, and you can run one universe of DMX at no charge. And then, of course, another company is Flying Pig Systems. Now, with theirs, you do have to buy some DMX interface or control surface as basically the license to use it. But all of these manufacturers will let you download their software and play with the software for free. And some of them will even let you provide your own DMX interface and get the software going for free. So that's really nice now to help people get stuff going in their studios.
Good advice, good places to start and learn. And I will put those companies and products in the show notes. I'll be writing the show notes up probably tonight or tomorrow. So, Brett, if you can think of any links you want to send me to be in the show notes, just shoot those over to me by email right after the show. Wow. I've learned that I don't know very much about this. And I know a little bit more now. So, Brett, if folks want advice, I'm sure you don't want everybody calling you. Is there a website you found that just has some good tutorials, or should people just Google this, or what do you think?
As far as good tutorials, I don't know. One of the things I hang out on several Facebook groups. There's a group called Everything Stage Lighting on mm-hmm. Facebook. That's pretty much open to anybody. There's also, I'm trying to remember what the name of the group is. Hang on, let me find it here real quick. There is a do-it-yourself DMX and pixel lighting, which deals with ArtNet hardware. And then there's also a Facebook group called The Light Project that deals with DMX lighting. So, you know, and really and truly, any of the major manufacturers out there, they also have pretty much all their manuals and stuff online. I'd say probably some of the biggest manufacturers as far as stage lighting would go would be, as far as lighting control would go, would be like MA Lighting. Of course, I mentioned Martin, Flying Pig Systems, which is part of Barco. And then, of course, there's Lation and Chauvet. Another company I've actually kind of used some of their products recently, and they're here in Minnesota, I think, in the U.S., is a company called Blizzard Lighting. And they have some nice entry-level fixtures that I've been using on some of my personal projects and stuff. So, like I said, because there's quite a few more manufacturers out there, it's brought the price down and gives you a lot of options. You know, the only thing I kind of advise people against is watch out for the really, really inexpensive stuff. You do kind of have to, when you get into the really cheap stuff, you have to be kind of buyer beware, because, you know, one of the things that you might see as an issue between really inexpensive fixtures is, you know, going back to the transmitter discussion with Harris and stuff, or Gates Air, is that the low-end products may not have very good quality control between different products. And, you know, they may do a run of fixtures, then get a different supplier and do another run of fixtures. And you may end up with two basically the same model of the fixture, but one has a different light output or whatever. And so, you know, when you go with the really inexpensive stuff, you have to be aware of that, the quality may not be there. So, but, you know, when you tend to stay with the major brands, you'll have, pretty good success. And, one other thing I was going to just kind of mention as just a quick note, if you have something like a performance space that's not being used all the time, many of these lighting fixtures, especially with the moving light fixtures and stuff, they tend to have fans and stuff in them. And anytime those fixtures are turned on, typically those fans will be running. Some of the fixtures do have a remote shutdown command. Other ones don't. And so something to consider in a space that's not used all the time is, you know, think about shutting that equipment down where it's when it's not in use, because otherwise, you know, you may have to end up, you know, opening up those fixtures and stuff to clean them out, because, you know, you are talking about equipment that needs, you know, generates heat and needs cooling. You know, even an LED fixture, even though it's LED and it's got a lower heat output, LED fixtures, especially these the chip on board elements, they can generate a significant amount of heat, and they need, you know, fan cooling and stuff to otherwise they'll burn up.
Oh yeah, good deal. All right, we'll get these in the show notes. And Brett, thank you so much. There's a world out there that I know nothing about and I'll know a little bit more about now. So at least I know it's there, and our listeners and viewers know it's there now too. Hey, Chris Tobin, thanks so much for being with us from Rutgers.
You're welcome.
Good luck on your show tonight. Hope it goes well.
It will. Thank you very much.
All right. And Brett Gilbert, thank you for joining us from Oklahoma. Appreciate your expertise here, and good luck on future shows that you do.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks also to Suncast, our producer back at the ranch, controlling everything, and to Allison Andrezarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. I'm Kirk Harnack. Hey, next week we're going to be talking about virtual radio and some people that are actually doing it with servers in the cloud, running their radio stations in the cloud. Some folks from way up north in the Yukon are making this happen, because, you know, it's hard to drive around the Yukon anyways. They kind of need to have this remote access. So join us next week for that. It's going to be a good show. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.